Fred, what have you done now?
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show. On demand. We have a great show for you today. Joining us on the program, his name is Peter Melman. Peter Melman was the executive producer, co-executive producer of the most watched, the most famous, the most popular television show of all time. He was also one of the head writers throughout several of the key seasons of Seinfeld. Yes, Peter Melman joins us to talk his career, obviously how he got the job, working for Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, two of the greatest comedic minds of all time. He also talks to us a little bit about basketball. We recorded this previous to the NBA Finals, so we talk a little bit about LeBron and MJ, talk about James Harden, and then we talk about his time with Howard Cosell. Yeah, Peter Melman talked to Howard Cosell, and he shares an interesting story about how he got a job at the Washington Post, because he's a woman? Awesome stuff with Peter Melman. Hey, I want to thank my guest last week, Rex Andrews, for sharing his story. Real emotional interview toward the latter part there when he starts talking about his dad. Really big props to Rex for being open and honest and candid with me on the show. Really appreciate that. And I also want to give a shout out to Stevie Ray, Angel Corona, and Abel Andrew Jackson. We hopped on the line and we talked about the big fight, Mayweather-McGregor, which we'll be talking about more here on this show. So stay tuned. Working on a lot of things. Thank you for those who checked out the SE Scoops Wrestling Podcast, which I host. And Back to the Future of the Podcast, Season 4, coming soon. Okay, last thing I want to say before I get to the Peter Melman interview is I want to give a special shout-out to Jason, the Solomon Monster Solomon. He celebrated his 500th episode of his podcast, Solomon Monster Sounds Off. I appreciate him for giving me a shout-out there at the beginning of the show. I'm returning the favor, and I want to get I thought about calling into his show because I had something I want to talk to him about. I'm going to actually put in the word for him today to see if I can get him on this show in the coming weeks. I have something I have to talk about with him. So I'm going to reach out to the Solid Monster, those of you who are fans of him. So now, without further ado, let me get to my interview with the one and only, the incredible, the super talented and funny, Peter Melman. Peter Melman joins me right now. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got nothing to do, and I'm sitting here talking to Houston. What could be bad?
There you go. I like it. Well, thank you for coming on the show. Hey, it's exciting to have you here. I mean, I've been a fan of yours for quite some time. I actually, believe it or not, it took me a while to put draw a line in connection to you and Seinfeld because I actually came onto you from your sports show.
Oh God. Yeah, that was fun.
That was such a great show. Peter Melman's Wide World of Sports. Is that right?
Narrow World of Sports.
I'm sorry. Narrow World of Sports. That was such a great show. Did you like doing that?
I have to say that was probably the most fun I've ever had working.
Really?
It was just so much fun, and it was easy, and, you know, we had this tight little crew. And, you know, once I got Kobe Bryant to do it, I could pretty much get anybody. You know, like, people were, like, excited to do it. So, yeah, it was really fun.
No hopes of maybe returning to that show someday?
Actually, I'm supposed to be talking to somebody about that pretty soon.
Okay. I like the tease. I think right now would be a great time for it because sports overall is so great right now, but basketball, to me, has become a year-round sport. And I know you're a big basketball guy like I am, and I think it's become the most, I don't know, the sport with the most stories going on at it at one time. What'd you think of the NBA season so far this year?
You know, I know the playoffs hasn't been great as far as drama or anything like that, but, you know, I think every NBA season is pretty great. And, you know, the only the only real bummer about this season is some of the big injuries that happened. You know, I hated to see like Zach LaVine go down, or the kid on Milwaukee who I love. But you know, otherwise it was, you know, it was a great season. To me, they're like all great seasons. I just love the NBA.
Oh, it's the best. What did you think? I got to get Peter Melman's opinion on it. I'm a Houstonian. Obviously, I'm a Rockets fan to the day I die. What did you think of the Rockets' performance this year and then in the playoffs?
I thought they had an incredible season, and I'm like a huge Harden fan. I actually think he's like the most talented offensive player in the league. And I thought they were amazing. You know, like D'Antoni did a great job. They have a really good chemistry now. I just love some of the people they've gotten. You know, like I love Trevor Ariza on any team. You know, when he was with the Lakers, he was just that kind of guy who, you know, doesn't stand out, but he loves playing defense. He hates when anybody scores off him. I love having a guy on the team like that. And, you know, they're just a really cool squad. There's some, I thought they'd do better in the playoffs. I was a little bit surprised. I have to say I was almost amazed that they didn't do better. I thought they were going to give San Antonio a real run.
Oh, I did too. I wanted to see from the beginning of the season, like everyone was pretty sure that we're going to see the Cavaliers versus the Warriors. But I thought that my Houston Rockets were the one team that could shoot with the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals, and we might see an upset. That was what I had my heart set on. And then, you know, they let me down. James Harden, as great as he is, he let me down in the game six against the Spurs. It was hard to watch.
Yeah. Well, I feel for you.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Well, Peter, you've had actually, real quick, who's your pick to win the finals?
You know, I'll tell you, I'm not as I'm hoping for Golden State. Just I don't even know why, but I think people are kind of underestimating Cleveland. I'm shocked that Cleveland is such an underdog in the series.
I know they're two. I think Vegas has them 2-1, and they have the best player in the league in the world.
They have the best player in the league. They might ultimately have the second best player in the league. I mean, you know, people don't talk about Kyrie Irving as much as they should. This guy is really special. And not only his skills, which are off the charts, but he's so calm. He's such an adult out there. You know, I mean, he's telling 10-year veterans to just be cool, relax. Everything's going to be fine. And he, you know, he's the guy who's going to hit that big shot for them. If they're down by one, you know, with 5 seconds to go, he's getting the ball for me, not LeBron.
Oh, 9 times out of 10. I think I would take Kyrie Irving over Steph Curry almost any day of the week. I think he can shoot. He can handle the ball better. I find him better at the one position. And I think he's got a great, great shot.
You know, I don't think you could go wrong either way.
Well, yeah, no, of course, yeah. But I like Kyrie. I really do like Kyrie a lot, and I agree with you, and I'd give him the ball. I mean, he proved it last year in Game 7 of the Finals. He hit that big three, and that really solidified Cleveland's win last year. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on Kyrie Irving. So what do you think, real quick, one more thing on sports. Do you think LeBron James this season passed Michael Jordan of all-time playoff points scored? Where do you sit? Do you think LeBron is going to pass Michael as the greatest of all time? And I guess the better question would be, do you think Michael Jordan's the greatest of all time?
I do think Michael is the greatest of all time. I just do. You know, as far as pure basketball, I don't love Michael as a guy. But, you know, there's no denying how great he is, or was. And, LeBron, but, you know, LeBron is just, he's just ridiculous. I mean, his size, everything, it's just, I think the only thing that'll keep LeBron from being seen as better than Michael is that his game is not as beautiful as Michael's. You know, aesthetically, you know, his shot isn't beautiful like Kobe or Michael. You know, but, you know, nuts and bolts, he's a better passer than both of those guys. And, you know, obviously a better rebounder. And if he gets a defensive rebound, it's basically a basket or a foul at the other end, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But Michael's legend is going to be tough to match. And, you know, it's also that time, you know, he kind of, you know, he was so gigantic as, and still is, you know, commercially and everything like that, that his legend just gets bigger and bigger.
No, I mean, I think you're right about that. I think chasing the ghost of Michael Jordan is going to be the biggest challenge for LeBron James. You know, you obviously are a fan of basketball. You love sports. You have the sports show. I found out, doing a little bit of research with you, I mean, obviously I'm on sports radio. I do broadcasting for sports and professional wrestling. For me, I found out that you got to work with the greatest of all time, Howard Cosell. Is that right?
Yes. How? 2.5 years on ABC Sports Beat, which was kind of a sports journalism show, not unlike the show that Brian Gumbel has now, or, you know, one of those E60 kind of shows. It was like the first real hardcore sports journalism show. It ran from 1981, I think, through 85. I was there from 82 through 84. And, it was like being in the center of the sports universe. I mean, you know, there wasn't one person in the world who Howard Cosell couldn't get on the phone in 2 seconds. You know, he was the biggest thing. He was a bigger star than any of the people he'd interview. You know, so it was, and he was incredibly funny. People don't know that about him. He was incredibly funny and great to be around. And, you know, humor was like a really big thing, a big priority for him. I walked into his office and he was meeting with Harry Edwards. I don't know if you know who that is, but he was the man who organized the Black Power salute at the Mexico City Olympics in 1968. He's a brilliant philosopher, and he's 6'8" and, you know, a 6'8" bald black guy with a mustache, and he wears sunglasses with a beard, and he has, you know, there's something kind of intimidating looking about him, and he's so brilliant. And I just dropped something off in Howard's office one day, and this is what the typical thing he would do. He'd say to me, he looks at me and says, "Peter, while you're here, what do you think about black coaches in the NFL? And I know he's expecting me to say something funny. So I said, "I don't know. There seem to be enough black players on the field. Do they have to coach too?" And Howard goes, "That's an excellent point, Peter." And Harry Edwards is looking at me like I'm crazy. And then Howard starts laughing, and I start breaking up, and Harry Edwards just busts out laughing hysterically. And, you know, those were the kind of, like, greatest moments with Howard Cosell. It was just, it was amazing.
You know, I mean, I saw Howard Cosell in a couple of the Dean Martin roasts, and, I mean, he was phenomenal. He had great, I mean, at least from my estimation, he had great, like, comedic timing and a great sensibility about it. I mean, even if you go to his interviews, all of his interviews, I mean, he just had a nice rap with people.
He was just unbelievably funny, and I never met anybody who kind of enjoyed and reveled in his fame like he did. You know, he knew he could get away with anything, and he just did. He could say anything at any time. You know, I remember him interviewing some manager. I forgot, you know, one of those really old-time baseball managers, you know, in the majors, and, you know, one of those old kind of gruff tobacco-chewing guys, And at the end of the interview, Howard says, "Okay, one more question. Why is it that you hate the Jewish people?" And the guy goes, "No, I don't." And Howard goes, "I'm just screwing around with you." You know, I mean, he would just do these things that it would be so much fun to be around him, you know, and it was just great.
Oh, man, that's an incredible. I love Howard Cosell. I could talk about him all day. I mean, just such a talent. So you worked with Howard Cosell in 82 to 84, you said. But I was doing a little bit of research on you, and I found out you did something that was hilarious. You wrote a letter. So you found out that the Washington Post was hiring. And tell me if I get this right. And you write a letter to him as a woman because you found out that they weren't hiring men at the time or white men or something like that. And so you wrote them a letter as a woman to try to get the job.
Yeah, that was right after I graduated college. A guy who had – I was at the University of Maryland, which is, you know, 9 miles outside of Washington, D.C., and a guy who had been the editor-in-chief of the student newspaper was working as a copy aide at the Washington Post. And we were talking, and I said, God, that's such a great job. I'd love to get in there. And he said, the problem is that they're not really hiring white males, you know, because they definitely had a shortage of women at that time. And, you know, Washington, D.C. was about 83% black, I think, at that time. And so, you know, it was completely understandable. But, you know, I figured I'd try to get a work around it. And I wrote a letter under the name of my friend, Faith Michelle Cates. And it was a really funny job letter. And by mail, you know, obviously the times were different. They offered me a job with really awful hours. So I didn't know what to do because, you know, they would be expecting a woman. So I wrote another letter explaining why I wrote the first letter. And then they were so kind of like blown away by the audacity of it all that I got to go in and I met with like all the biggest editors of the Washington Post. And, you know, ultimately I got to write a lot. You know, I got to kind of get in the sports section.
Oh, man, that's such a great story. So, like, when you wrote the letter, you just had no – did you think that you were just kind of sending it off and you really didn't expect to hear back?
No, I expected to hear back because that's how stupid I was. I fully expected to hear back, which is, you know, ridiculous. But, you know, ultimately I did hear back.
You know, I mean, given your writing history and some of the shows you wrote for, it seemed like that idea might make it into a script for Seinfeld or something like that. I mean, it sounds like a great idea for a TV show.
You know, it's funny. I never really thought of it that way, but you're right. That would make a great episode. That would have made a great episode of something.
Yeah, maybe a George.
In fact,
story
I'm now kicking myself that I didn't think of that because, you know, for a good part of the Seinfeld, George was unemployed. It would have been a great thing if he had written a letter as a woman
to get a
God,
job.
Why didn't I think of that? Can you believe this? This is 20 years later, and I'm talking to you for the first time, and you're giving me a Seinfeld idea I should have done.
Well, hey, I'm just trying to help. I'm doing my part. You know, so you wrote for Seinfeld, obviously one of the biggest shows of all time, if not the biggest show of all time. How did you get your start? I mean, I think you met Larry David out somewhere, correct?
I moved to, from New York to Los Angeles. You know, I had been at the time after working for Cosell, I just started writing magazine articles and I became a freelance magazine writer and I was really kind of enjoying that life. Although, you know, the effort to, you know, pay your rent was kind of Herculean, but, you know, I was writing for, you know, GQ and the New York Times and a lot of women's magazines and stuff like that. And, I just felt like I kind of needed a change. So I moved to Los Angeles. And I bumped into Larry David, who I had met in New York like once or twice. And he knew that I was a writer. I don't think he knew that I had never written a script. And he said, you know, I'm going to be doing this little show with Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe you should give me a writing sample and I'll pass it on to Jerry and maybe you could, you know, write a script. So I gave him an article, a humor kind of essay, very New York oriented, that I'd written in the New York Times. And, you know, I later found out that Larry had made the same offer to several people who, you know, I had also known. And, you know, they all turned in scripts. And somehow the only thing that Jerry responded to was this article. So I got to come in there and, you know, they gave me, at that point they had shot four episodes. So they gave me the tapes of those four episodes and I watched them. And I got like really nervous because I was thinking, oh my God, this is so good. This is actually something I'd want to do. So, you know, I got to write a script and I didn't really know what I was doing, which I think in a way was an advantage at that time. But, you know, I put in one clutch performance in my life and next thing you know, I was loaded.
So you never wrote any kind of script before? It was just articles for different magazines?
Yeah.
So when you get the job to work on Seinfeld, and you sit down, I guess, at your typewriter or your computer on the first day, what was going through your mind? Did you have any idea of how to structure a show or anything like that? I mean, I'm guessing you hadn't written any dialogue or jokes, you know, between characters. How did you kind of figure that all out?
The jokes and dialogue came kind of easily to me. What was really difficult and is still somewhat difficult and will always be difficult is story structure and things like that. That's really hard to learn. And that's what I had absolutely no training in. But, you know, as far as writing dialogue and things like that, you know, I had that kind of like right from the beginning. You know, like in my first episode, I had a run in there where Jerry and George are arguing about who is the bigger idiot between the two of them. And they're both arguing for themselves, you know, like I'm a much bigger idiot than you. And, you know, that was like perfect Seinfeld dialogue. And I think what really helped me in that regard is that, you know, having written for like the New York Times one day and GQ another day and a woman's magazine the next day and the Village Voice the next day, you know, I got to kind of alter my own voice a little bit. Because, you know, you couldn't write the same style for all those different publications. So I think I had a good ear for that kind of thing. But, you know, writing stories was very, very, very difficult. You know, I was also good at, you know, coming up with ideas for the show. But figuring out where they go and how you get the characters in trouble and how you get them maybe out of trouble. And, you know, that stuff was really, really hard. And I wrestled with it kind of throughout the course of the show.
And that was always going to be my question. I would always wonder, like, for a show with the stories are so rich and the ideas are so great, where would you find, where would you find the inspiration for some of these? I mean, you wrote some of my favorite Seinfeld episodes of all time. I think one, The Apartment, I love that episode. I think it's so funny. Where would you come up with these ideas? Would you just sit in the writer's room and kind of rack your brain, or did you kind of have to go out and experience?
I wish there was a way, especially back then, I wish there was a way that I could lean on to actually come up with ideas. I would say the best answer to your question is that I tried to get lucky. Larry David was incredible at listening and like overhearing people's conversations or even causing troubling situations just to see what would happen. So I tried that. That didn't really work so great for me. You know, but I don't know. I just, you know, the thing is, I had to change my way of thinking, which was when you're in journalism, you know, you're looking out at the world and reporting on it. When you're on Seinfeld, you kind of have to get into your own thoughts. You know, it was like your own tiniest little thoughts were always the best sources of story ideas on the show.
Yeah,
and we did not have a writing room, by the way.
There was no writing room?
No, we were, I think one of the reasons the show was so good is that Larry and Jerry didn't really know what they were doing, and they never had that kind of structure. Or, you know, you basically came in and you told Larry and Jerry what ideas you had for all the different characters, and they would say, yes, I like that, no, I don't like that, and then they would say, okay, use those ideas, and then they'd like send you on your way, and you were, you know, in your office, and it was up to you to write a script.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, you say, you know, they didn't know what they were doing. I remember hearing Jim Carrey say one time that ignorance leads to innovation, and I guess that's kind of what you're saying. Like, you didn't know what you're doing, so you had to figure out how to do it in your own way. So that's interesting.
Absolutely, and a lot of the hallmarks of the show kind of happened by accident. You know, all of a sudden Larry started connecting the storylines, and that became like a thing where you kind of had to connect up all the storylines. And, you know, the characters, each of the characters got so big that you really needed, you know, stories for all of them every week, or, you know, hopefully the best thing would be like maybe three stories where two of the characters are involved in those stories. So, it was a very tricky thing, and, you know, you had to kind of keep up with Larry's creativity, you know, and his creativity really evolved. And so, you know, it's very tough to keep up with.
You know, there's a lot made of, like, I remember seeing something that, like, you know, Larry's material fit well in Jerry's delivery. How much of the show, or if not all of it, but how much of it was dependent upon their relationship and their overseeing of it? I mean, they worked so well together as a team. What do you think it was about them together that made the working environment so good and made the show so good?
I think the smartest thing Jerry ever did was, after being offered a TV, you know, to do a TV show, that he picked Larry David to write with him, because, you know, you couldn't find two people who were more different in a way. And I think that's what really worked. You know, it was kind of like a Lennon and McCartney thing where, you know, Larry was kind of darker and, you know, kind of like Jerry looked at the big picture of things, and Larry kind of like looked at the minutia of things. They just worked perfectly together. You know, my office for much of the show, for probably the last 4 years that I was on the show, was, you know, right next door to Larry and Jerry's office. And, you know, I hear them rewriting a script or writing a script and hear them laughing constantly. And I'd be like, so jealous, you know, like, God, they're having this, you know, this stuff that's such a slog and so hard for me. And they're just like laughing it up all the time.
So it's just the perfect marriage between two individuals to create that show. You know, you mentioned that Larry, when he kind of went on, like, to connect the stories. For me, I know in season 4, which is one of my favorite, if not my favorite season of Seinfeld, where they're pitching the Jerry Show and the creation of the Jerry Show. The show,
yeah,
within
that's
a show.
By far the best season of the show.
Yeah, I think from top to bottom, it's the best season they have. And you had some great episodes in that season, you know, The Virgin, The Visa, Implant, Smelly Car. Which I have to ask you about the implant, but my question is, was it hard to have to weave that overarching thread of the Jerry Show and the overarching story of season 4? Was it hard to weave that into your individual stories?
Yes. Yes, it was very hard. And I wrote one script that they actually really liked that was continuing the story, and they decided they had had enough with that thread. And so it really kind of was a bummer. But
what was that about?
That was difficult.
What was that story about that you wrote? That they had the script, I mean.
You know, I forgot exactly, but it happened. I was writing it. It was something about a humidor and the cigars. And, you know, once Kramer's cigar burned down Susan's family cabin, mm-hmm. you know, that happened, like, just as I was finishing my script. So, you know, like, it all of a sudden it seemed like the cigar story had run its course. But, you know, it happens. And, you know, some of them... I didn't really have to deal with that problem too much. You know, the smelly car didn't deal with that, and the implant didn't really deal with this, you know, the season storyline.
You know, the implant to me is probably my favorite episode of Seinfeld of all time. And, you know, when I remember when I was a kid and, you know, I'm big into James Bond and I saw Tomorrow Never Dies. And I said, wow, I mean, Terry Hatcher, that's a, whoa, you know, you have to log that one in your memory bank. And, yeah. If so for you, was she, I think I heard somewhere, I couldn't find it, but was she your inspiration for writing the show?
No.
What was the inspiration for writing the show? The implant?
I was at my health club talking to somebody and, a woman walked by with an incredible body and, you know, like my head kind of turned and the person I was talking to said, oh, come on, they're fake. And I was just thinking, you know, that would make a great little moment where that they would be in a health club. That would happen. They'd say, ah, oh, they're fake. And then that would be it. It would just be like one of those side trips that Seinfeld always took. Then I started thinking, you know, this could be a bigger story. This could be like, you know, doing the detective work could be really interesting. And, that's how it came out. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, when we were casting it, I think we had one woman come in to read and she was okay. And then the casting person said, how about Terry Hatcher? And way too quickly, I said, yes. I had just seen her at a restaurant like a week before. And, you know, again, this was a dinner with a friend where I barely heard a word because I'm just staring at Terry Hatcher. And she was such a doll on the set. She was a blast. You know, she's really athletic and everything. So she would like, you know, like after a rehearsal, she'd like, hey, let's shoot some baskets, you know? She was great.
Oh, wow. That's a great woman right there. Wants to
shoot, she was tons of fun and just, you know, a really, really great girl, you know.
And she was really funny.
I bumped into her once in a while. I haven't in a while, but, you know, she's just a doll.
And she was very fun. She was really funny in the show. One thing, you know, the thing about Seinfeld is you can watch these episodes 100 times and a different line will stick out to you. Every time that makes you laugh. I saw this episode on TV not too long ago, and Elaine says to Jerry, I thought you were more of a leg guy. And he's like, a leg? I have legs. And for some reason, I laughed about that line for all week. I was like, I have legs. I just thought it was so funny. And then, of course, you know, the line everyone remembers is they're real and they're spectacular. When you wrote that, did you know, okay, boom,
I have to say Larry wrote that line.
Oh, he did? He did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's such a great line. It's such a great,
it's great and it's big. But, you know, I always like the little lines, you know, like that one you just mentioned, I always liked. And another one I really like in that episode is when Jerry says, where George is at that is with the priest at that at his girlfriend's house in Detroit, and the priest says to him, like, you've been a great comfort to, you know, the girl, and George says, well, you know, losing a loved one, you know, forget about it. You know, that's what I love. Forget it. You know, just in a dark moment like that, throwing out this tiny little meaningless, colloquialism. That's the kind of stuff I really love.
You know, I saw an episode, I think it was The Fix Up the other night. And Jerry is explaining to Elaine, you know, why George is a good catch. And I just remember he said, you couldn't tell by looking at him, but he can bait a hook. And I just thought that was another one that just killed me because it was just so like he was reaching for something positive about George and he can bait a hook. But when you talk about the implant, they're real. They're spectaculars in the lexicon, of course. But also, you know, double dip a chip is one of those things that's like I didn't even know that was a Seinfeld thing until much later in life where I started watching the show more. And, you know, I heard double dip from literally you know, I'm born in the early 90s, and I remember hearing Double Dip my entire life. That was just a phrase. And I know you're credited with coining that phrase, Double Dip. How did that come about?
You know, I was at a party, and somebody actually got, like, a little bit, you know, annoyed at somebody saying, you know, you shouldn't, like, you know, do that. You know, you're putting your germs, like, in if you do it twice. So I thought, oh, that's a really funny thing. And, you know, then it wasn't it wasn't any stroke of genius to come up with the phrase double dip, you know.
I think it's so great. It's great.
Yeah, that was kind of, yeah, that episode just came together, and I had a bunch of storylines. I just had a bunch of actual scenes that seemed like they would be really funny, and somehow I meshed them all together. And at that point, I thought, oh, and it worked out so well. I thought, I got it. Now I know how to really, like, I'll never have any problems writing another Seinfeld episode. That system never worked again.
It was a one-off, one time only.
It worked one time only.
Did
you know, I just had the thing about, you know, some George arguing with a for the death and the family fare at the airline counter. You know, I had that lying around. I always liked the idea of somebody getting into a fight, you know, at a wake. You know, it was just like a whole bunch of things, and somehow I smushed them all together, you know.
Was the implant, you know, when Double Dip came out and They're Real, They're Spectacular, I know that was season four, so you had a few episodes under your belt, but was that the first time that you kind of saw the impact of the show and it's like instant influence on pop culture?
Yeah, that was kind of the first time. Yeah, that was like the first time where, you know, Double Dip, you know, it kind of got out into the lexicon. I was like, wow, this is great. On the other hand, you know, it kind of gives you unreal expectations for the rest of your life. You know, you start thinking like everything you write, you know, or you was, you know, you what you're hoping to, like, you know, have an impact on the culture of society. And, you know, I got lucky with a bunch of those, you know, like Yada Yada and Shrinkage. But, you know, it's very hard to penetrate this culture, especially the way it is now, where it's everything's so diffused, you know, like the hottest show in the world gets, you know, maybe 3 million viewers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's so spread out. You have so many options and so many different places. The internet, television has 1,000 channels.
I was like a big, huge fan of Mad Men. And, you know, like it's always like staggering to me. It was like a brilliantly written show. And every year it would have this commercial tie-in with Banana Republic, and every one of the actors would be on the cover of magazines. And, you know, like if they got 2.5 million viewers of any one episode, it was like a huge week for them.
It's so much more fragmented than it was, because Seinfeld would get what? How many millions per episode?
You know, like, I mean, when it got big, you know, 35 million.
Crazy. Just crazy.
And, you know, I mean, in the first couple of seasons, it was, you know, until it moved to Thursday night, it was, you know, not doing great in the ratings. We were getting beaten by Jake and the Fat Man.
Jake and the Fat Man.
And then we, but, you know, it was getting some kind of, it was getting a lot of critical notice. And then when it moved to Thursday night, it like shot through the roof. And yeah. Of course, Larry David asked a comment about that, said, if they weren't watching us on Wednesday, we don't want them on Thursday. Which, of course, the network people were like apoplectic over that comment.
I'm sure, but it's a classic Larry David style comment. I mean, just sounds exactly like him. You know, you talk about all the great phrases that you got out there in the lexicon, yada yada, which is used by everybody, shrinkage, one of the greatest Seinfeld moments of all time is when she last sang, I'm really sorry. And he just says, I was in the pool. I mean, it just so fantastic. One though, that I actually say a whole lot that I love. It's another one. That's one of those little things. That's, I don't know. It just makes me laugh. Like I have legs makes me laugh. Anti-dentite to me was so funny. I just thought that was such a funny phrase. You know, next thing you know, you're going to say they have their own schools. They do have their own schools. Ah, I mean, it was just such a great story. And I thought that would be so much. I mean, everyone would say anti-dentite, right? I mean, I know that was probably your idea, too.
I thought
that
would catch on, too.
Yeah.
You know, when I wrote it, that was like the only time I said, oh, God, you know, this is going to be a thing. And, of course, it wasn't.
But then the end of the episode is so great. You know, dentist, who needs him? And then, you know, you know, not to mention the blacks and the Jews. I mean, these things were just, I mean, anti-dentite, did you have like a brush with a dentist or something? Or was that just something that, you know, a story that popped in your mind?
You know, the whole idea of, you know, I have my closest friend in the world grew up Catholic, and then he converted. And one day, you know, we were just lunching or talking or something, and, you know, he had made some kind of like little Jewish joke, and I had this thought, like, I wonder how long it took him before he felt comfortable saying a joke like that. And then I was thinking how funny it would be if it was like the next day, like after he converted, he was like immediately making Jewish jokes. And that's what started the episode. And so, you know, I just really loved Bryan Cranston, so I had him be the guy who converted. And then, you know, it was by accident, you know, and that kind of just, you know, led to, you know, a whole dentistry thing and anti-dentite.
I love that episode so much. You know, I noticed, though, when I look at the episodes that you wrote for Seinfeld, some of them, honestly, I mean, I'm not even joking, are my favorites. The Implant, one of my favorites. The Betrayal, I think, is such an underrated episode by how funny that is, and the idea to do it in reverse, which is just, I think, phenomenal. But I do notice that a lot of your stories center around, like, Jerry and Elaine. And a lot of them are Elaine. You know, when you talk about the sponge, you know, are you sponge-worthy? It's an Elaine episode. She has a lot of big lines and big stories in most of your episodes. And I know you said you wrote for women's magazines. Was it easier for you to write for Elaine or write for women?
It was easier for me to write for Jerry and Elaine because I think they were, you know, comparatively normal characters. They weren't, you know, as extreme as George and Kramer. And that, you know, most people had a much easier time writing for George and Kramer. You know, I liked writing a lot for Jerry, and I liked stories for Jerry. In fact, I had so many Jerry stories that I used to end up giving them to Kramer. You know, like when he had a low sperm count and he had to switch to boxers. You know, my original thought was that would be a good Jerry story, but then, you know, I kind of like flipped it over to Kramer. I never thought that you could have a truly great episode unless Elaine had a strong part in it. So, you know, I was very aware of that. And I was really proud of the sponge because everybody was like saying, oh, my God, I guess that was written by Carol Leifer, right? Like, even to this day, people say, did Carol Leifer write the sponge episode? I'm like, no, I wrote it, you know, a guy.
How did you come up with that one, though? Being from the male perspective, you know, it's the episode where Elaine has the today's sponge is being discontinued and she stocks up on them and then she's real. And that's another episode, Peter. I got to tell you, the line where you're going to do something about the sideburns is another one that kills me all the time when I hear it. But so how did you come up with that one? Did you just like read an article that they're doing away with the today's sponge?
No, I heard it on NPR in my car. That one came about and never happened again, where I heard in my car that the sponge was going out of business. And immediately I thought to myself, you know, if Elaine is a sponge user, she'd probably stock up before they run out of them on the shelves. And let's say she gets like a limited number of them, that would change her entire screening process for who she sleeps with. And boom, you know, like I had almost the whole show.
Just off that one little
gift from the heavens. happened to Larry David like every day.
Yeah, you just hear something.
To me once.
Yeah, well, hey. You know, but, you know, when Larry left, was it season 7? After season 7 he left or before?
I think it was after he left after season 7, and I left after season 8.
I read
the show left after season 9.
Yeah, yeah. I read somewhere that you were credited with kind of steering the series kind of in the right direction without Larry David being there. You know, you were executive producer or co-executive producer of the show, and you were credited with kind of keeping that Larry David quality and helping steer the show. Would you agree with that?
No. I mean, I did all I could. You know, I shouldn't even say that. You know, I certainly didn't consciously do it. And looking back, if I had to do it again, I think I probably would have been much more assertive in doing that. But, you know, whatever I did, I just basically was, you know, stuck in my role. Not stuck, but, you know, I was very locked into my role as just, as a person who just writes scripts. You know, I didn't want to run the show. I didn't want, you know, I happened to have given out a lot of stories that year, you know, to other scripts that I think were kind of Larry David-y ideas, or, you know, just the small kind of slice of life stuff, you know, like the whole thing about the English patient, you know, and there were several others. I was like giving away, you know, a lot of my ideas because, you know, without Larry, it was, you know, much more of a struggle.
Was it, that's what I was going to ask. Was it like for the first time having to ride the bike without the training wheels? I mean, was he there to kind of help always guide toward the right direction?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a big thing when he was gone, you know, it was, you know, he was the complete creative force behind the show. So it was, you know, it was really a tough adjustment.
A couple more things, Peter, before I get you out of here. I mean, this is such a great conversation for me. I have to ask you about Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I had a conversation with somebody last week. I was just watching I was catching up on the newest season of Veep, which I think is just a highly funny show, great writing. And I came to the proclamation that I think she might be the funniest, you know, actress comedian of all time, you know, not stand up, but just funniest woman on television I really ever seen. What's your opinion of Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her incredible talent?
I kind of would have to agree with you. I mean, I just, you know, she's just mind blowing, you know, like you never, every line you wrote for her, you'd hear her say it the first time and it would never come out like you thought it would sound. And then you'd go, oh my God, her way is like 1,000 times better. You know, she's unbelievable. I mean, she's a force of nature and, you know, and a great person too. So, you know, I mean, she's just, you know, like if you, once in a while, like if I would give a suggestion to her about, you know, the motivation behind the line and she would go, oh yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good. You'd feel like the greatest person on earth, you know, just because like Julia loved your idea.
No,
you know,
yeah.
And she did, you know, and she was, like you said, you know, I wrote a lot of stuff for her and she was like always super appreciative.
Yeah, I just think that she's so funny. And when you watch her on Seinfeld, she's a completely different character. Well, obviously she's a different character, but the way she's delivering lines, even in Veep and the way she does everything, it's a completely different person and character and in cadence from Elaine, but both are just such funny, funny characters. And I think she's the only person who could pull that off. And,
I think the funniest thing about Veep and vis-a-vis Julia is that, you know, I don't think you could be an American and speak English any more beautifully than Julia does. You know, she enunciates words so perfectly. I love listening. I always loved just the way she speaks. And now to hear her on this show saying incredibly vile things in her perfect diction, it makes it like 30 times funnier for me.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, she definitely is. I mean, her cadence and the way she speaks and her pronunciation, like you said, it's almost melodic and it's very staccato. It's rapid fire, but it's just, oh my God, she's so good on that show. And of course on Seinfeld. I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You said you left after season 8 of Seinfeld. You were going to take a deal with Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks. Was that a difficult decision to leave a show that was so massive and that you could write something and it'd be instantly pop culture and you'd get all this adulation for it. Was it a hard decision to do?
It wasn't that hard at the time, just because, A, I was a little exhausted at that point. And, you know, I knew that if I started my DreamWorks deal now, which I had put off for several seasons, I had that deal, you know, signed, but I kept putting it off to stay at another season at Seinfeld and then another season. So anyway, at the end of that season, I was kind of exhausted and I was thinking this. And so that was one thing. Then I kind of had the feeling that the next season would be the last one, and I didn't want to be like one of 18 Seinfeld writers who were out there pitching shows the next season. So I thought I'd leave a little earlier. And also the last episode I'd written that season was Yada Yada. And, you know, it was a very small episode, you know, with tiny slice of life stuff, you know, kind of a throwback episode.
Yeah, I was going to say, comparative to season 8, season 9, which were really massive in scale and a little bit goofier.
Yeah, I mean, this was really just a small story. And so I felt very good about leaving on that note. And I have to tell you the truth, I knew that my office was going to be on that lot, the same lot, and if I came up with a great idea for the next season, you know, I could probably still write a script without having to be there day to day and, you know, and be slogging away. So, you know, I mean, the betrayal was after I was gone. I wrote that with Dave Mandel, and that was, you know, that was season 9. I wasn't even there.
And that was a great episode, too. It was one of the best, of season 9. I love that. I love the idea of that show. So it wasn't a difficult decision for you to make, but you were still around, so you could contribute when you needed to. When we confirmed this interview a couple days ago, I actually purchased your novel on Amazon, It Won't Always Be This Great.
You're the one.
That's me. I'm the guy. I can't wait to read it. I know I read the synopsis. Sounds like a great idea. Any more novels down the pipeline? Anything you want to really start writing again, or was that kind of you wanted to try it for that time?
No, I've actually written another one, and now I have to now I'm just kind of like sticking my foot in the process of getting it published. I think it could be a tough one to actually get published because for too many reasons to go into here. But you know, I enjoyed writing it, and that's the most important thing. And you know, so I did that, and, you know, I've actually started doing stand-up about a year and a half ago.
Oh, how's that going?
It's a blast. It's so much fun.
That's got to be the most difficult thing, I think, in the world to do. I mean, when the great musicians of all time, it's still not one guy out there. It's a band, or one woman, I should say. It's a band out there. You have a production. You have lights. You have this. You have that. You know, if you go to a concert nowadays, there's massive video screens that are distracting you from this and that. And there's multiple costume changes. It's just a big production. But with stand-up, it's literally you, a microphone, and a spotlight. I just think that and to be able to get people to emote from that, I mean, I just don't see how there's anything more difficult.
I know. A lot of people say that. And on the other hand, it seems like everybody and their uncle is doing stand-up now. So that's kind of a weird paradox that, yeah, everyone thinks it's so hard and everyone's doing it. And, you know, the only thing that confirms the fact that it might be really hard is that, you know, so many of these people aren't funny.
Well, you know, if you're not funny, you might be pretty difficult.
They all seem like they went to the same, like, stand-up comedy class. Talk about yourself. Talk about who you're dating. Have super energy up there. You know, I don't do any observational stuff, and I, you know, or it's just slipped in the context of something else. And, you know, like, I have no energy. I don't, you know, take the microphone out of the stand. I just stand there. I don't even really acknowledge the audience.
Well, you know what?
To me,
it's a good
thing. They're kind of like just in the way.
Yeah, it's just an unnecessary obstacle there.
Can you stop laughing? You know, like, I'm trying to get out of here.
I'm just trying to do my quick set and get out. Well, Peter, I thank you so much for taking the time. I'm looking forward to the return of your sports show, if that does happen. I'm going to be there to support it all the time. And you can go to your website at pmelman.com. You're on Twitter as well. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. This has really been fun.
Thanks, Peter.